Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Lizzie Peabody. It's a beautiful morning for a stroll in the grass. And not just any grass. So in front of me is the Capitol building. Behind me is the Washington Monument. And in between is just huge swaths of green, like a big green soft carpet. It's the kind of grass that makes you want to kick off your shoes.
That's me wiggling my toes.
The smell of fresh-cut grass in summertime takes me right back to childhood. Summer evenings when it stayed light after dinner and I could go outside with my brothers and play. And we'd come back in all sweaty and itchy from tumbling around in the grass of our yard. Here, on America's front yard, you'll find people all summer long. Snapping photos, tossing frisbees, playing kickball, reading, sunbathing. And in spite of all the wear and tear it gets, the National Mall is the poster child for the all-American lawn. All the same green, all the same height, not a weed in sight.
Soft, fuzzy, a little bit damp. It's nice.
But what does it take to make a lawn that looks so perfect? I knew just who to ask about this because just a few paces away,
go past the carousel. Past this little fountain next to the castle and through the gates of the Hauptgarten.
Tucked behind the Smithsonian Castle is Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how are you?
Jeff Schneider is the deputy director of Smithsonian Gardens, but I have also heard him called the Turf King. And one of the many patches of grass Jeff reigns over is the parterre. A lawn so flawless, it is officially too perfect to walk on. But you can stand in front of it.
Everyone wants to stand in front of the parterre, get a picture of their family with the castle in the background. So that is kind of our Kodak moment for visitors here at the Smithsonian.
But a picture-perfect lawn requires a lot of work. First, there's mowing and edging.
Aerating, which is punching holes.
Overseeding.
Then we follow that up with lawn fertilizer.
To help the grass grow, and herbicides to keep the wrong stuff from growing.
Mainly broadleaf weeds.
Of course, then there's regular watering, and then because of the moisture.
And then we do a few fungicide treatments throughout the summer.
Jeff estimates it takes about 90 hours of work and 72,000 gallons of water to keep the parterre green year-round. And this patch of lawn is only about as big as a basketball court. But the parterre is like its own work of art. Its value lies in how it makes you feel.
To me, it kind of gives me a cooling effect and a relaxing effect just from the carpet of green.
Yeah. I don't know, it looks straight out of a painting.
Well, thank you. I'll take that as a compliment.
Yes. Americans do a lot for the love of the lawn. Lawns extend from Maine to California to Florida, including many places where grass would never naturally grow. And each year, Americans spend 20 trillion gallons of water on lawn care. Turf grass is one of America's largest crops, but it doesn't feed us. So why do we go to all this trouble for something that doesn't make sense, economically or ecologically? This time on Side Door, we go digging into the past to find out how the aesthetic of the perfect lawn became so deeply rooted in the American psyche, and what our lawns say about us, historically and today. That's coming up after the break.
Side Door is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
When I think of the classic American lawn, this is the image that comes to mind. A boxy little house with a front walkway, maybe some flowers along it, and in front, a tidy square of trim green grass. This image is so baked into my brain, it doesn't even feel like a choice. It feels like a default setting.
It is a default setting.
This is Cindy Brown, manager of collections, education, and access at Smithsonian Gardens.
And we often do things that we have no idea why we still do them. What made us start doing that to begin with?
When we trace the origins of the American lawn, we quickly find it's not originally American.
Well, it came from Europe. In England and Scotland, lawns were seen as an elite part of your estate.
In Europe, grassy lawns were a status symbol among the nobles and aristocrats of the 17th century because they were intentionally impractical.
Think about it. You had money to be able to spend on something that really didn't do anything for you.
To have a lawn was essentially to say, I have enough food that I don't need this space for a garden.
Right.
And I have enough money that I can pay someone to take care of it just because. Like, I live a life of abundance.
Exactly. This lawn was purely a statement on you. Your status in society.
Along with the British, the lawn hopped the Atlantic, and even the American Revolution didn't stop it from taking root among this new country's elite.
If you are trying to emulate what you think the rich and the powerful are doing, wouldn't you copy how their estates look?
George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were like, "Keep your monarchy!" But we'll take the green, green grass, please and thank you.
So if you go to Monticello or you go to Mount Vernon, you're going to see lawns. You're going to see that green swath that sets off the perfect abode.
Just like in Europe, only the privileged could afford lawns because of all the time and work they took. And who did the work?
The enslaved people were the ones that would have to tend the lawns and use scythes to cut it by hand.
So in the early days of our nation, you'd really only see lawns at the homes of wealthy landowners and slaveholders. But that started to change in the mid-1800s, when trolleys and streetcars made it easier to travel into and out of cities. The growing middle class started to build homes on bigger plots of land in what came to be called the streetcar suburbs. Paint a picture to me, for me. Like,
okay.
I don't have a good mental image for the Victorian era suburban lawn.
Go look up Andrew Jackson Downing.
Andrew Jackson Downing was a horticulturist, author, and is widely considered to be the father of American landscape design. He'd probably be better known today if he hadn't died young in a steamboat accident. But for Downing, landscaping was about more than projecting a certain image. It was about character. He believed a house's architecture and surroundings could affect the tastes and morals of its owners. He wrote, "When smiling lawns and tasteful cottages begin to embellish the country, we know that order and culture are established."
In fact, he even wrote books to show you if you had this size property, what could you do? If you had this style of house, what could you do? I think of him as the early Martha Stewart because he did. He put out books and all his designs included grass. So if you're going to be the end people, you're going to follow along with that.
Downing envisioned yards that imitated nature, but improved on it. Exotic trees to replace native ones, rare flowers to replace common ones. And he wrote, "Smooth turf instead of wild meadow, bespeaking the presence of a tasteful and enlightened mind." And who doesn't want to be tasteful and enlightened? Even Victorian-era suburbanites had Joneses to keep up with, and they needed their lawns to reflect their innermost virtue and intellect. And that required tools. What did it take to care for lawns at that time? Because there were no lawnmowers and there were no hoses, so how did they do that?
Well, actually, they did start to have lawnmowers and hoses. Very good, because lawnmowers, the early lawnmowers, started in the early 1800s.
In 1830, an Englishman patented the first mechanical lawnmower. It looked kind of like a low-slung grocery cart made of cast iron. In other words, very heavy.
And from 1830 onward, they just kept making improvements upon the lawnmowers.
There was any number of designs out there of lawnmowers. They were even, dog-drawn mowers.
Oh, my gosh.
So people were coming up with all kinds of ideas in terms of making their lives easier.
This is Joyce Connolly. She's a museum specialist at the Smithsonian's Archives of American Gardens. She handed me an advertisement from 1897.
Wow. Peter Henderson and Company, New York. Lawn Essentials.
That shows a man in a bowler hat sitting on what looks like a sleigh.
Doesn't it look kind of like a sleigh?
It does. Yes.
It reads,
"The Coldwell Improved Horse Lawn Mower. We guarantee this to be the best and most perfect horse lawn mower manufactured."
The man is holding a whip, and in front of him is a white stallion. The fine print states,
"Oh, the new attachment for instantly raising the knives when traveling along roads and stony places is very convenient." Wow, $60.
As equipment got better and better, lawns became increasingly affordable for more people. These tools were advertised in seed catalogs, and advances in color printing technology made dreamy lawnscapes look even more enticing than ever.
The seed catalogs were beautifully illustrated. This was before color photography, obviously, and the illustrations were colorful and homey. They really drew you in. It was almost Eden-esque, what they were selling.
One ad from 1910 shows a woman in an extravagant hat and floor-length white skirts, pushing a dainty mower.
There are no grass clippings on her dress. There's no, like, grass stains at the edge of her hem. Like, this is clearly a fictional depiction of a person mowing a lawn.
Absolutely. The seed companies were also responsible for pushing the idea of lawns. And there was money to be made. So between equipment and seed supplies, it was very important.
By the early 1900s, sprinklers became widely available as well.
Because that amazing amount of growth really does take a lot of water and a lot of nutrients to be able to make it grow. Our native grasses are not the same. They grow and then they stop and then that's it.
Cindy Brown says these turf grasses, like the concept of the lawn, were imported from the damper, cooler climates of Northern Europe. They needed help surviving in most of the U.S.
We had to adapt the environment to match the look we wanted.
Exactly.
But pretty soon, innovation would begin to change the grass itself, thanks to...
games. Games did it.
You know, horseshoes, badminton, croquet, and most importantly...
the biggest game of them all, golf.
Dun, 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 dun. Golf!
In the 1920s, we had a golfing craze. It was the thing to do. It affected what we planted, how that turf was grown, because golf is really hard on turf. I mean, getting hit by that little stick and running around and people
it's
with...
called a club.
So the USDA at the time created a tougher grass to be able to be planted on golf course.
Wait a minute, the U.S. Department of
Agriculture? Yes.
The USDA worked with the U.S. Golf Association to develop hybrid grasses that would stay green almost all year long. That is, with the right chemical products to support them. When we come back, how envy, prosperity, and wartime bombs brought the American lawn to explosive new heights. After the break.
Support for Smithsonian Side Door comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/sidedoor. That's odoo.com/sidedoor.
We're back, and we're talking about the roots of the American lawn, a concept imported from Europe around the time of the Revolutionary War. But it was another war that made the perfect suburban lawn quintessentially American.
What does World War have to do with growing grass?
That's a really neat question. Surprisingly much.
Abir Saha is the curator of agriculture and engineering at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. He says the thing that links war with grass is nitrogen.
The primary ingredient in both explosives and nitrogen fertilizers is ammonia, fixed nitrogen.
During World War I, factories were making a lot of bombs. After the war, these factories were repurposed.
Instead of just letting all this equipment and technology sit idle, instead of producing explosives, now you can produce fertilizer for your front yard.
You might say there was a fertilizer explosion. A lot of bomb-making factories became fertilizer factories. And following World War II, there was a new market for this fertilizer.
Veterans returning after World War II took advantage of government policies like the GI Bill to not just return to school, but also to buy homes.
In the 10 years between 1946 and 1956, more Americans purchased homes than in the previous 150 years. New suburban communities grew up almost overnight.
5 years ago, this was a vast checkerboard of potato farms on New York's Long Island. Today, a community of 60,000 persons living in 15,000 homes, all built by one firm. This is Levittown.
Beginning in 1947, the housing developer Levitt & Sons mass manufactured whole neighborhoods of houses.
Levitt towns begin to spring up, first in places like Long Island and then throughout the country. And what they are is essentially mass manufactured homes and housing complexes.
Why not mass produce the elements that go to make up a house, just as the auto industry does with the parts that go into a new car?
A Levitt town house could be built in a day, and every single house had a lawn.
And because the Levitts decided that every house needs to have a lawn, you now are starting to create a pattern in all the other housing developers that come after.
But the Levitts, like many other housing developers at the time, would not sell homes to African-American families. So the image they created of the new American suburb was a white one. And with the help of the new national highway system, these white suburban enclaves sprouted up across the country. And with them, this vision of the model lawn.
The value of the home begins to get tied with how beautiful it looks on the outside, which means a bright green front yard.
Just as Americans in the Victorian era had signaled their moral virtues and cultured taste through the plantings in their yards, Americans in the 1950s were signaling, too. Rows of perfectly trimmed front lawns gave the impression of a united, well-kept, homogeneous community. All white, with all green lawns.
And you're also starting to see the rise of a culture of conformity, right? It's the Cold War. No one wants to be labeled a communist. And in order to be a patriotic American, you need to be like all your neighbors.
Americans knew that the tallest blade of grass is the first to be cut. And in the era of the Red Scare, it could be dangerous to stand out.
So you have Americans wanting to toe the line and sort of participate in the American dream. And what does that look like? That looks like, a barbecue on your beautiful green front yard.
Your lawn said something about who you were, whether you belonged.
Citizenship, yeah. What it means to have a lawn became equated with what it means to be American.
American Americans had something to prove with their lawns, and a whole industry rose to the occasion to satisfy that need.
Weeds are our common enemy, plaguing the homeowner, ruining golf courses, and our tempers.
This is a 1947 ad for one of Dow Chemical's new herbicides. In addition to the synthetic fertilizers that promised explosive growth, new chemical herbicides could target specific weeds without killing grass, making the first all-grass or monoculture lawns possible.
The sprayed plants are dead. Those which were protected are, of course, thriving nicely.
A growing suite of home improvement magazines drove home the idea that the suburban homeowner, master of his domain, was just one product away from a golf course-worthy lawn that would be the envy of all his neighbors.
And so you're beginning to see the industry push for a certain kind of lawn, and then consumers, homeowners, imbibing that ethos and making it their own, really owning it.
The forces set in motion over a century ago, cultivated by industry, advertising, and social convention, continue to act on us. Today, lawn care is a $60 billion industry. That all-grass, all-green, all-American lawn is more attainable than ever, thanks to a whole arsenal of tools designed to keep our lawns on life support.
We joke that they're chemically dependent. Traditional lawns are chemically dependent.
This is Sylvia Schmeichel, lead horticulturist at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History.
They need a lot of fertilizer. They need a lot of water. That means they need a lot of mowing. So that means you need a lot of fuel. And then you have other diseases and pests that you're trying to get rid of if you want that perfect, pristine lawn.
We now know that many of the fertilizers and pesticides developed in the post-war era are harmful to humans and wildlife. Excess chemicals run into waterways, damaging ecosystems and killing millions of fish and birds each year.
And so I think it's important to remember what you put on your site doesn't necessarily stay on your site, and it has impacts to your greater natural world.
Sylvia says the more perfect your lawn looks by industry standards, the worse it likely is for the environment. In a world facing climate change, it's worth asking what a perfect-looking lawn actually says about us today.
First of all, I want to roll in this. I haven't rolled in a lawn in a while.
In front of the National Museum of Natural History, Sylvia is showing me a different kind of lawn.
Is it pretty comfortable to sit on?
Let's see.
My butt is wet, but yes. This is a pollinator lawn. If the traditional American lawn is a velvet carpet, then this is a shag rug.
What does it take to make a pollinator lawn?
So the difference is that we have a higher, what's called a higher threshold for species of plants other than turf grass.
Okay.
So if we find clover, that's okay. We leave the clover. We know that it provides nectar to the pollinators.
The pollinator lawn is better for bees and wasps and requires a lot less work than an all-grass lawn. It needs less water, less fertilizer, less mowing, and the mix of plant species supports beneficial insects, which means no pesticides.
So basically, like, you're giving me permission to have a lazy lawn.
Yes, permission to procrastinate granted.
But what if procrastination is not an option? What if it is your job to maintain a perfect-looking lawn? Back on the pristine monoculture parterre, Jeff Schneider, the Turf King himself, has some tips.
So there are ways to have a beautiful grassy lawn and minimize the impact to the environment. Like, what do you advise for homeowners that you're putting into practice here?
Sure. So about 10 years ago, we switched from synthetic fertilizers to an organic-based fertilizer. So I would certainly suggest that to the homeowner. Now, that adds a little bit of cost, but we feel that it's worth it. And actually, also about 10 years ago, we moved away from gas-powered equipment in the garden and specifically for lawn care.
Today, Jeff's team uses battery-powered mowers and trimmers using solar charging stations in the garden.
So we're not only off of the dependency of gasoline, but we're also off the electrical grid.
But even if you can't build a solar charging station for your battery-run lawn equipment, there are other ways to minimize your lawn footprint.
Big thing, mow your grass as tall as you can. If you have cool season grass, that goes a long way to reducing the amount of water that you need. The other thing I would mention is we irrigate here, but that doesn't mean you have to irrigate at home.
Jeff says you don't have to water. It is fine to let your grass go brown.
Just because it turns brown doesn't mean that it's dead. It just means that it's gone to sleep for a while and it'll come back.
I didn't realize that. I figured if it was brown, it was gone.
No.
But your best bet of all is to go with plants that would naturally grow in the region where you live, which, depending on where that is, might not be grass at all. Letting go of the idea of the perfect lawn goes against generations of messaging we've received as Americans, that our lawns reflect who we are and what we value. But it's worth taking a look at where those ideas come from and whether we want to carry them forward. As Abir Saha says, every single yard is a piece of a bigger puzzle.
Anything happening at such a large scale is going to have some negative impacts. And in this case, you know, your lawn isn't feeding the world. So what is your lawn doing that justifies the costs associated with it?
The American lawn has always been about more than just grass. It's a space we create, where we can play, eat, lounge around with friends, pets, and family. We define what that space looks like. It's a choice. And it's okay to choose imperfection.
The idea of not having a perfect lawn, like, it's okay to be imperfect. And it doesn't mean that you are, you know, a bad citizen or there goes the neighborhood type of situation. It's a thoughtful reconsidering of what the idea of a lawn is.
Maybe being an engaged citizen today means having a lawn that doesn't look like everyone else's.
Right. It doesn't look like your grandfather's lawn or your dad's lawn. You know, it's a new way of, like, rebelling, right? The modern rebel has clover in their lawn.
Forget
right?
The sex, drugs, rock and roll. Plant some clover.
Resist the monoculture.
You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. If you're wondering more about how to make the most of your lawn, we have more tips and tricks from Smithsonian Gardens horticulturists in our newsletter. We'll also include ways to search for your nearest cooperative extension service. Jeff, the Turf King Schneider, says cooperative extension agencies are the best place to go for the latest research specific to your growing region.
They are the experts. I would suggest to anyone that they go and read up at those sources instead of relying on commercials and sales pitches on fertilizers and other things.
And if you're interested in a pollinator-friendly lawn but worried about what your neighbors might think, Sylvia Schmeichel has advice.
One, having conversations with your neighbors. If they're like, hey, what's going on? You're like, well, I'm doing this on purpose. Keeping clean edges. Mm-hmm. So it does look like it's maintained.
Intentional.
And, like, sometimes putting a sign up that say, look, this is a native habitat. This is a pollinator-friendly lawn.
That's all in our newsletter. You can subscribe at si.edu/sidedoor. This weekend, June 30th to July 4th, 2022, the Smithsonian Folklife Festival is on the National Mall in collaboration with the Smithsonian's Earth Optimism Initiative. In the words of Secretary Lonnie Bunch, Earth optimism shows us how to find hope in the face of odds that might seem overwhelming. It reminds us that change happens when we focus on what works, when we collaborate to find solutions and celebrate our successes. If you're in the area, check out the festival. You can find out more at festival.si.edu. And if you're in D.C. at all this summer, take a ramble through the Enid A. Haupt Garden behind the Smithsonian Castle. You can recharge in the shade of the garden and even charge your phone at the solar charging stations. And if you have your own Kodak moment with the parterre, tag us. We're on Twitter and Instagram at SideDoorPod. Special thanks this episode to Cindy Brown, Jeff Schneider, Sylvia Schmeichel, Joyce Connolly, Kelly Crawford, James Gagliardi, and the rest of the wonderful crew at Smithsonian Gardens. Thanks also to Abir Saha and Valeska Hilbig at the National Museum of American History. Our podcast team is James Morrison, Natalie Boyd, Anne Kinnanen, Caitlin Schaefer, Tammy O'Neill, Jess Sadek, Lara Koch, and Sharon Bryant. Episode artwork is by Dave Leonard. Extra support comes from Jason and Genevieve at PRX. Our show is mixed by Tarek Fuda. Our theme song and episode music are by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to sponsor our show, please email sponsorship@prx.org. I'm your host, Lizzie Peabody. Thank you for listening. And go let your lawn be long.
Conformity, of height and how easy it was to be able to do the game of golf on it. So they copied it.
Sorry, I just love do the game of golf. That's like something I would say as a non-golfer.
Doing the game. And there was other games too, so...